Joe Gould was one of those legendary New York characters. He claimed to have invented oral history and to be working on a groundbreaking 9-million-word history of the 20th century. Now, when Joseph Mitchell, the famous New Yorker writer, heard about this, he decided to investigate. He wound up writing a long story about Gould. It was one of the most popular profiles ever published in The New Yorker, and this was all back in 1942. Joe Gould died in 1957, but there was no sign of that 9-million-word manuscript. So Joseph Mitchell wrote a second story, a quarter century after the first one, in which he claimed there never had been a manuscript. Joe Gould just made the whole thing up. And this has been a mystery, a literary mystery about Joe Gould and about Joseph Mitchell ever since. And now along comes another New Yorker writer, Jill Lepore, and she thinks maybe that manuscript did actually exist. And she set out to find it. The result is her book, Joe Gould's Teeth. Steve Paulson sat down with her to find out more.
Yeah, so I reread the essays for classes teaching at Harvard, and when I was rereading it, I'd forgotten that a ton of the story involves Harvard. Gould claimed to have graduated from Harvard in 1911, and he said that at his death, the entire manuscript would be given, well, two-thirds would be given to the Harvard Library and the other to the Smithsonian, and that he carried around a will deeding it and making that arrangement. And so I was kind of getting ready for class, and I thought, oh, shoot. Maybe someone should just check. I should just go to the library and see. Like, maybe it's there. It'd be hard to lose 9 million words in, you know, hundreds of dime store composition notebooks, but bigger things have been lost in the Harvard Library. So I went over to the archives, just a couple steps from my office, and I went to the undergraduate records files, and I pulled Joe Gould's undergraduate record file, Joe Gould, class of 1911. And normally these things are like a sheet. It's like a transcript, or, you know, maybe there's one other page, like a letter to a dean or something. It's a stack. It's a good ream of paper, maybe more. Almost all of it, letters from Joe Gould, who has very distinctive handwriting and very clearly illustrated one fact that Mitchell got right, which is that Gould had graphomania. This is a person who could not stop writing. I mean, this is this outpouring of letters to his deans, to each of his professors. This is like your worst email nightmare, the person who will never leave you alone. It's all crazy. And just looking through the first few pages, he didn't graduate in 1911, as he told Mitchell and as Mitchell reported to readers. He was kicked out. He had a nervous breakdown. He was unable to do his work in any case, and he was not allowed back because of his mental illness, which seemed, on the basis of these papers, to be quite grave for him even as a very young man. There were just all kinds of crazy clues and hints in these letters that I, you know, sat and read in a day that led me to believe that there was much, much more to the story of the oral history of our time than Mitchell knew.
But why did you then think that maybe that oral history really did exist?
There are hints of such a project in the letters in the record file. So I thought, well, I'll take a few next steps. Because, you know, when Mitchell was writing these pieces, Gould's letters would have been at the Harvard archives, but Gould wrote to a lot of other people. You know, these databases exist of where people's papers are, so you can search by name. And I went to see, well, were any of Joe Gould's papers in the papers of anyone else? So the papers of E.E. Cummings or Ezra Pound or William Carlos Williams or Marianne Moore or The Dial Magazine or New Directions Press or Lewis Mumford or Edmund Wilson or The New Republic or The Nation, any of the places that Gould wrote for, people that he knew and worked with, people that testified about him to Mitchell. And it turns out all these people's papers are in archives now because they're long since dead and their families collected their papers and they've given them to archives. And they all have correspondence files titled Gould, Joseph. So then there's this sort of chase. And okay, well, I'll just see. So I wonder, oh, I'll look at E.E. Cummings' papers and just see. Well, there's stacks of Gould letters in the Cummings paper. And a lot of the letters are about the oral history. Huh. And it doesn't seem fictional to either of the correspondents.
Or it's the greatest con ever done that, you know, somehow Joe Gould managed to tell, you know, the who's who of the literati that he had written this. And they all ended up writing about it in their own papers.
But you can imagine, as a historian, oh, your ears kind of prick up. Because the harder it is to disprove that it existed, the more likely it is that it did once exist. And if it existed, even if only some portion of it still survives, wouldn't that be really important? What if this guy really did write down what people said on an ordinary day in 1924? There's a whole dimensionality to the past that it offers that we just don't have for that period. And in particular, Gould was obsessed with the Harlem Renaissance and spent most of his time not in Greenwich Village, but in Harlem. So what if he had written down what Langston Hughes said to me in a coffee shop one day, what Zora Neale Hurston said when I went with her down to the library?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't you want to have that? Oh, well, the chance seems slim, but I better keep looking. So then I really got this book, and it was dreadful.
Okay, so you did find some excerpts from this oral history.
What became obvious reading the correspondence of these other writers who knew Gould far better than Mitchell ever did, they'd known him for decades, was that Gould had been insane from childhood. He had suffered from a severe mental illness from childhood, but he had been first locked up in the 1920s. One of the reasons that he was brought to insane asylums repeatedly was because he was known to attack women and was considered dangerous. And Mitchell had some glimpses of this. One woman wrote to him at the time and said, you know, Gould was actually a monster. You've got him completely wrong. He's not some charming eccentric. He was a monster. But the monstrosity of Joseph Gould comes across pretty loud and clear early on in the correspondence. That doesn't mean the oral history exists.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. It's not dispositive one way or the other. But it means that if something has been hidden, what's been hidden, what I know to have been hidden or not seen by Mitchell, maybe that he didn't understand, was that Gould was not a harmless person.
Well, and then there was another piece to that as well. I mean, he seemed to be a racist, right?
Yeah, which doesn't distinguish him from pretty much anybody in his society at the time. But he was obsessed with race, which does distinguish him from a lot of other people. He had one particular fixation, which was he was obsessed with the idea of sex between a white man and a black woman. He was a eugenicist in his young life, and he had worked for the Eugenics Records Office collecting pedigrees and documenting the skin color of Native Americans in the Midwest. And he was fascinated by the degenerative effect of the darker races on the lighter ones, but also on the ameliorating effect. I mean, Gould had a really complicated set of ideas about race. In any case, he was obsessed with racial mixture, and it seems that his attentions to women were directed almost invariably at black women.
I presume he thought the whole idea of mixing races was a horrible idea. I mean, if he was a eugenicist, and yet he himself was personally fixated on black women.
Yeah, so he did and he didn't. He was an unstable person, so his ideas are not fixed, nor are anyone's ideas about this question particularly fixed in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s. He, as a young person, as a eugenicist, was very vehemently opposed to racial mixing because he thought it would interfere with racial equality, that in order for the races to become politically equal, they needed to be racially distinct. This is a sort of weird kind of inverted Garveyism. He, in fact, reversed that idea, and it became insistent that the races should mix, and that in particular, this one black woman should have sex with him, and that if she didn't, it was because she didn't believe in racial equality.
He pursued this one black artist, well-known in the Harlem Renaissance, Augusta Savage, and apparently, he basically stalked her for years.
Yeah, and this was really hard to reconstruct archivally because Savage seems to have destroyed most of her own papers, indeed much of her own art. And I think most of that has to do with her difficulties with Joe Gould. Savage was the best-known artist of the Harlem Renaissance. She was a sculptor. She was a sort of social center for artists. She also taught a lot of Harlem Renaissance artists, so her real legacy is actually in her students, people like Jacob Lawrence. In any case, Gould met her in 1923 when she was giving a poetry reading with Langston Hughes and Gwendolyn Bennett. He, you know, later said he fell in love with her at first sight, and from that day forward really never left her alone. She seems to have tried to go to the police, didn't get any assistance from them. Gould, when he was brought before the police for harassing other women, was repeatedly let off. Well-known writers like Edmund Wilson and E. Cummings would go to the police and testify on his behalf as character witnesses and get the charges dropped. But much of the hype about the oral history of our time, it turns out, was the efforts of Gould's white modernist writer friends to protect him from being arrested and being sent back to a mental institution or being sent to jail. And there's really only one person who leaves behind an evidentiary trail that makes it possible to see what was really going on. And it's this writer named Millen Brand, who's a white man but goes on to become really active in the civil rights movement. And he knows Gould through his wife. And Gould asks him to intervene with Augusta Savage and help bring them together. So Brand goes to talk to Augusta Savage. This is in 1934. And says, you know, I'm good friends with Joe Gould. You know, he's this great writer. He really loves you. And I guess you guys had some kind of misunderstanding or something. And I just hope you'll give him another chance. I mean, he's really heartbroken. And Savage, this person has been making my life daily miserable, unutterably miserable. He never leaves me alone. He calls me. He comes to my shows. He writes me endless letters. He wants to marry me. There's a lot of intimation that there's been sexual violence. But Brand writes this all out in letters to Joseph Mitchell in 1964 after Joe Gould's Secret comes out. And he says, Brand is himself a very successful writer and has spent most of his career as an excellent literary editor. And he says, you know, I really loved your piece, Joe Gould's Secret. And it was a beautiful piece of writing. But I just want to say, you're totally wrong that the oral history didn't exist. I read it. And the longest parts of it were about Augusta Savage. And it was actually quite a fascinating and skillful and quite important piece of writing. You know, I wouldn't put it past Joe Gould to have destroyed it all.
Yeah, wow. What eventually happened to Joe Gould?
Right after Professor Siegel came out in The New Yorker in 1942, days after that, really, he had another breakdown and was committed to the Manhattan State Hospital for the Insane. Mitchell goes to see him when he finds out months later, because he'd actually is so delusional that they, you know, no one's able to find out his name or figure out who he is. But Mitchell finds him and goes to see him, and the psychiatrist tells him that Gould's a psychopath. He manages to be released from the hospital after some time with some social services. He's supported for a number of years, 3 years, by a very interesting psychiatrist who's curious to see if, relieved of the daily struggle of finding enough to eat and a place to sleep, Gould could actually produce this great work that people believed was in his head if it hadn't been written down. He's clearly a spectacular person in a thousand ways. So he's supported, and he still doesn't produce that work. And he ends up back in the hospital and in and out of the hospital for a number of years until he's finally brought to Pilgrim State Hospital, which is the place where lobotomy is perfected. And I wasn't able to get his medical records from the hospital, but I found a lot of circumstantial evidence to very strongly suggest that in 1947, Gould was lobotomized. And so he dies 10 years later in that same hospital. Mitchell gets a phone call about it. One of Gould's other friends, Slater Brown, who'd been probably his closest and longest friend, gets a telegram from the hospital, and he asks, were there any papers? Did he have anything in his possession? And the director of the hospital says, not a scrap.
Wow. So what do you do with, I mean, not just what do you do with a story like this? I mean, you've written a book about it, but what do you make of someone like Joe Gould, who was fascinating in some ways, but rather repellent in a lot of ways? And I mean, the story that you discovered about him is mostly kind of awful.
It is mostly awful. And at a lot of points, I thought about just dropping it. I had a sort of feeling that it was a cursed story, that Joe Gould had set his curse upon Joseph Mitchell.
So Joseph Mitchell's last great piece for The New Yorker was the second profile of Joe Gould, and he basically doesn't write anything substantial for another 30 years, even though he keeps going into The New Yorker office every day. Something about that experience seemed to have blocked him in some monumental way.
Well, I thought about that when I was sitting in the New York Public Library at my desk, and they brought out the letters. There are a lot of letters from a lot of people saying, oh, my God, it's the most beautiful story I've ever read. But P.S., I knew Joe Gould, and there was an oral history. I have some of it. Would you like someone like me to send it to you?
Meaning what Mitchell was being told was that the greatest piece he ever wrote, perhaps, was wrong. And he had to live with that.
And he had to live with that. But I think the way in which it was wrong had been for him an act of incredible kindness and generosity. Both essays were, to him, a way of shielding and protecting this broken man and making something beautiful of what was really terribly ugly. But then when I got to the Millen Brand letter and the Augusta Savage story, Gould's obsession with Augusta Savage, to have gotten that wrong, I don't know, Mitchell. And actually, a few months into the project, all I wanted to know was Augusta Savage, which is infinitely more interesting than any of these people and much more mysterious. And that's the piece that I walked away with really troubled by. Because as a historian, I've always sort of thought about the historical record and its asymmetry. We know so much more about the literate and the wealthy than we know about the illiterate or the poor, as an artifact of circumstance, not as something that's deliberate. But then I thought about, well, we did have apparently at some point, because Millen Brand read it, an incredibly powerfully written account of Augusta Savage and her daily life as a working sculptor in Harlem in the 1920s and 1930s. And either Joe Gould destroyed that or Augusta Savage had him destroy that. In any case, right after Professor Siegel appeared in 1942, Augusta Savage left New York, left all of her friends, left Harlem, left her students, left her studio, left her sculptures, and moved to an unheated, tiny little house on a hill in a very small town in upstate New York where she had no electricity, and she lived there for the rest of her life in solitude, essentially in hiding, and is known only for having made the effort to send people to New York to destroy works of her own art. And so what I was left with ultimately is the very terrifying lesson that that asymmetry of the historical record isn't a function of circumstance, but can be a way that people who don't want to be known as much as historians might want to know about them erase themselves from the past.
Jill Lepore is a historian and staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Joe Gould's Teeth. She talked with Steve Paulson.